time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for May 16th, 2020. Well, spring has finally arrived here in Northeast Ohio. We have lots of rain, warmer temps, and everything is turning green. I love this time of year. This week, we're going to visit with titanium frame builder Brad Bingham. He's another one of those who was apparently born with the bicycle gene, building his first frame at the age of 18. He grew up on the West Coast. He decided to head to UBI for formal training and began in earnest to work in titanium with Gary Helfrich, who was his teacher at UBI. Soon he was scooped up by Moots, and the rest, as they say, is history. After a break, we'll head to Seattle to chat with Michelle Baruchman, the Seattle Times Traffic Lab Engagement Editor. What is that, you ask? So did I. But her article titled "Seattle Will Close 20 Miles of Residential Streets to Most Vehicular Traffic" caught my attention, so I contacted her about that and what else Seattle is facing as the city starts to open up again. So let's head on out to Steamboat Springs, Colorado, to speak with Brad Bingham of Bingham Built Bikes. Say that three times fast. Hi, Brad. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I did some diving into your background, and not only do I see a history that involves a lot of experience and study, but it seems like, you know, you were one of those guys born with the bicycle gene, and this started really, really early.
Yeah, perhaps.
Tell us a bit about where you grew up, how you got into cycling, and then how you decided frame building was the professional route for you.
Yeah, well, I guess a lot of things happened in there, but I grew up in the Northwest, so just a little bit west, southwest of Portland, Oregon, in a little town called Newburgh, which is now a much bigger town. And cycling, the cycling community there is pretty strong. The road riding there is great. And so I grew up doing a lot of road riding with my family and mostly my dad. So I think I, like so many people, was on my first bike around 3 years old and then kind of progressed through those, you know, those early years. And then actually got really excited for riding motorcycles when I was about 9 or 10 years old. So I started racing motocross when I was 13, and I always rode bikes during that time, but kind of those early mid-teen years, I spent a lot of time on motorcycles, and then grew out of that phase of my life and back on the bicycles with the mountain bike when I was about 17.
That's interesting. It's not exactly the usual progression. So a lot of people, it's like you did it backwards. You went, bicycle, motorcycle, bicycle, instead of bicycle, motorcycle, car.
Yeah, right.
But that's cool.
Yeah. Well, turning 16 kind of killed my motorcycle riding, because then I did get a car, and that kind of killed my motorcycle riding, but it kind of reopened my cycling for whatever strange reason.
whatever it was. So what happened after high school?
So I stayed in my hometown for a couple of years after high school and built my first bicycle out of steel in my mom's garage when I was, I guess I must have been 19 when I actually fabricated it, but kind of started the process when I was 18. And yes, I stuck around and chose not to go to college. Just wasn't that interested in it, to be honest. And then ended up, through a series of events, going to the United Bicycle Institute when I was 19 and got a job offer from Moots here in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. So out I came, and I've been stuck here ever since.
The rest is history. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brad Bingham. Bingham Built Bikes. I love that. It's like that nice little alliterative title. So you chose not to go to college, which I find both refreshing and interesting, that you realized that that just wasn't the path you took. So UBI unto itself is kind of an education, I would say. How did you begin to drift towards titanium as opposed to steel or aluminum?
Yeah, so my whole experience early on, just the whole genesis of building bicycles from scratch, really came about from me and a group of friends that I was riding mountain bikes with at the time. And my very, very good friend, Sean, is really the one who got me to build bikes. And after I built the steel bike, I kind of said, what's next? And he said, well, make one out of titanium.
And I see.
and so I rode Cannondales mostly in my mountain bike years early on, you know, again, teenager, 16, 17, 18. And so Cannondales were real popular in my area, and I almost built my first bike out of aluminum, but recognizing some of the challenges in building an aluminum bike, I chose steel because it was just something I could do easily in the garage. But material selection at that point, you know, early on, was really based on kind of what's the cool thing right now, what's lightweight. Wasn't so much about durability. It was more about what's light, what's high performance. And then after going to the United Bicycle Institute and learning about titanium and what a great material it is, it just, I really haven't looked back.
Yeah, I like titanium, by the way. Mm. We don't ride it, but I have ridden it, but I do like it. I like a lot of things about it. So do you remember who your teacher was at UBI? Who was that? Who was teaching Ty at that time?
Yeah, so kind of the we'll call it the chief was Gary Helfrich.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Okay.
Yep. And then Jim Kish played a major role.
Hmm.
And Ron himself was participating as
sure.
well. So we had a great crew of instructors. That might have been the last year that Gary taught. It was 96.
What the heck was the name of his jig, I guess it was? Arctic or
Arctos.
Arctos, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a character. He is a character.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great guy.
Yeah, he really is a great guy, and he's doing some interesting things now out in California that don't mm-hmm. necessarily have to do with bicycles that in that regard, but you know, he stayed sort of with the advocacy. So I want to talk about something you talk about on your website, and that you say, what is most important in designing and building a bike? What is most important to you? Because you don't actually, I don't know. Well, you tell me. Tell me what is important. Never mind. I'm not going to tell you.
Well, if someone like you or a client were to is asking me, you know, straight, what is most important? Well, for sure, the most important thing is that you have a good experience with the bicycle. And you know, all of the minutiae, all the small things that go into making you, the client, happy on the bike is what is most important. So really everything's important, right?
Sure.
But at the end of the day, really the only thing that matters to me is that my clients are happy and having a good experience. You know, not just with the product itself, but with the interaction that they had with me, and that they can come to me and for future advice, questions about their setup, and if for any reason they're unsatisfied with anything, that you know, that our relationship is solid and they feel comfortable working with me.
Do most of your clients come to you, or do you do a lot of remote stuff? Well, today, of course, nobody comes to anybody, but that's different.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I'd say quite a few are in-person meetings. Hmm. Probably 40% are in-person, and let's say 60% are, I never meet them face-to-face unless I happen to be in their hometown and look them up.
So if somebody gets in touch with you, clearly probably online, and says, let's start that conversation about a new bike, how do you accomplish your fit or your geometry or what you do to make that most important thing of making your customer happy?
Mm-hmm. So it's such a big mix, but many of my clients are longtime riders. So I would say that the majority of them have, in most cases, worked out their fit. They've gotten to a point where they understand their fit pretty deeply. So I can take and use an existing bike that they own as a foundation for my design. But I have a pretty simple fit form that they can fill out. It gathers body measurements and an existing bicycle measurements. And from there, I can suss out something would be smart to change through asking the right questions, find out where they need to evolve their fit too. But like I said, most are quite experienced and have a good idea of what they want. And I don't claim to be a fitter by any stretch, but I can identify glaring issues pretty quickly.
Right.
But then the other option is to come to me with a fit from a bicycle fitter.
Oh, sure.
And that works out quite well in 90% of the cases, for sure. I've certainly had a couple of clients who got a fit done by someone who gave them a very drastic change. And for a cyclist who has been riding comfortably for 20 years to then go to somebody and have them say, oh, everything needs to change, those are oftentimes the fits that I have problems with.
Yeah, sure. Big red flag goes up.
Exactly. And that's why I still, even with a fit, I will, even if someone's coming to me with a retool from whoever, I will also ask them to fill out my fit form.
Absolutely.
I can compare the two, identify anything that's really stands out as an possible issue. And then thirdly, the other option is I do work with a handful of fitters around the country. So I have a whole athlete in San Anselmo, California, kind of North Bay area. So I sell bikes through them. Tangent Cycles in Asheville, North Carolina is a fitter. And then FitWorks in New York City. And I think they also have a site north of the city as well. So.
Wow.
So there's a few options for sure.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Brad Bingham from Bingham Built Bikes in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Wow, that's really interesting. So you are actually doing some wholesale to retail.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the majority of my business, but it's a great part of my business.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about what kinds of bikes you're selling. What are I know everybody's asking for gravel right now, which to me, if you look back over the decades, you could say, well, it used to be Fuji's Touring 3. You know, it was just a bike that had cantilever brakes and wide tires and, you know, downturn bars. But what else are you building? What are you building that seems to be really popular right now?
Of course, the all-road and gravel bikes are super popular. So I am getting a pretty high number of requests for that. I'll be tack welding up two gravel grinders this afternoon. But I do quite a few mountain bikes. So typically hardtail 29ers. Generally speaking, and this is just being very general, they're for larger riders. So taller men usually. And then I do quite a few 27.5 plus mountain bikes. A lot of those tend to be the kind of more medium size riders, if you will. Can barely remember the last time I built a 26-inch mountain bike. And then my full suspension mountain bike that I build, I guess I only do a handful, and just a few of those a year. So mostly, you know, gravel obviously first. Road disc and kind of that all-road bike, up to a 35-millimeter, 38-millimeter maximum tire. Those are very popular.
So. Yeah, and they ride nicely.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. They feel good. I think we're going to take a real quick break, if that's okay with you, and we'll come back and we'll talk some more. Is that all right?
Sounds great.
Okay. We're talking with Brad Bingham of Bingham Built Bikes in Steamboat Springs. We're going to take our quick break, and we'll be back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
So we are back. If you're just joining me, you might want to listen to the front end of this conversation and rewind, but we're speaking with Brad Bingham of Bingham Built Bikes in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And by the way, he builds titanium custom frames, which we all love frame builders on this show. So I wanted to know how your customers are finding you.
Mm-hmm. Well, To be honest, I don't entirely know.
Great answer, by the way. That's awesome.
Because I don't pay a whole lot of attention to things like Google Analytics and such. But certainly through websites, through forums, through Facebook groups, NABS, the North American Handmade Bike Show,
sure.
has been just incredible for getting the word out. And, of course, I took over after having worked with Moots and Ken Erickson Cycles. I purchased Ken Erickson Cycles from Kent in 2016. So all of that has just snowballed into folks knowing about, you know, all those brands and what's happened, and it's just kind of all snowballed to me.
How many bikes a year are you building, and are you by yourself?
So it's myself and one other guy, and we're doing all of the production, and my wife runs the business, takes care of the books and the website and all that good stuff. So there's three of us full time, and then Kent Erickson is part time, and he's worked about 5 hours in the last 8 months. So,
yeah, well, that sounds like all of us, actually. Just kidding.
So he's pretty much retired.
Yeah.
And then I'm building right about 100 bikes a year.
That's a nice number.
Yep. It's going to be below that this year. April was definitely a little bit slower than the past, which is understandable. But yeah, I shoot for about 95 or 100 is my goal.
It's a great goal. I think we would all like to do that as custom builders. I think. Not everybody, but...
Yeah, maybe not everybody.
It's a reasonable goal for two people, you know, who are in the production end of it. So
yeah.
I also wanted to ask you who your customer is. Is it, obviously, it's probably mostly men, but you said something about taller men or bigger men.
Mm-hmm.
Do you specialize in bigger bikes?
I don't feel that I do, but I think that through the history of Ken Erickson, he had a great reputation of building stiff tie bikes. So he was an early adopter of some of the oversized down tubes and such, and larger chainstay diameters, so that he could keep those large and very large bikes still stiff. Because, you know, 20 years ago, titanium bikes were believed to be kind of noodles.
Right.
And a lot of that came from tubing selection. So yes, I do think that I have a nice niche in building large bikes, you know, for guys that are, you know, above 6'4", kind of that 6'3 to 6'7", even up into the 6'9 range that I've been doing. So,
Yep. Good. And they can't walk into a bike shop and buy a bike.
So, right, exactly.
I understand.
Yeah, but to your question about who my clients are, it's quite varied. I do get quite a few women clients, for sure. I'd still say, of course, they're the minority, but I get that demographic is wide. You know, it's from 30-year-old to 80-year-old, and just a really big mix of folks, from racers and Tour Divide riders to your most recreational rider you could imagine.
This is a weird question, one that I hadn't thought of. Are you doing anything with e-bikes? Anything with pedal assist?
I'm not. I am going to stay away from that for as long as possible, because it's just, I don't think it's something that really speaks to my strengths, you know?
Perfect answer. I get it. Absolutely. So I have a question to ask you about something on your website that I've never seen before. And I understand couplers. We've had bikes with couplers. We sell bikes with couplers. We build bikes. What is your coupled stem? What is that all about? A little tiny S&S coupler in a stem. What is that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually an 1.25-inch diameter coupler, and simply welded, you know, into the stem as the stem extension, because there are some frame geometries and sizing that allow you to leave the fork on and the stem and that partial bit of the stem in the S&S box.
Oh, it is for packing.
Yeah, so you don't have to readjust your headset or your stem position. You can just lock it straight on.
Well, and if you're doing, is it a tie stem that you're using, or
yes?
So that means it's a tie coupler.
Correct.
How cute is that? That is awesome.
Yep. I will say though that it only works up to a certain size road quick release bike. It's not applicable really to a gravel coupler bike or something that's on the large side.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what's the weirdest bike you've ever built?
Well, probably the weirdest request and build I did was while I was working at Moots, actually. We were doing bikes for Mike Kiriak. Do you know that gentleman?
I know that name.
So he's been part of the endurance cycling world for years, more in the early 2000s into the 2010 zone, we'll just say for now.
Okay.
So he's the only person who has ever completed the entire Iditarod bike extreme, whatever it is, the 1300 miles or.
Okay. Yes. 11. Yes.
He's the only one who has ever completed that. 100% self-supported. So he left from the start on a custom titanium moose that I built him that had, I think it weighed about 145 pounds when he took off in the snow. And it took him, I believe it took him 28 days.
Wow.
And he never went inside of a shelter and carried all of his own food. And that bike, the frame held white gas. So the frame was a fuel tank. And the rigid titanium fork legs were both fuel carriers as well. So was the handlebar, actually had fuel in it and had a Schrader valve on it so he could pressurize it and cook, run it directly to his stove off the handlebar.
Okay, you're right. That's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. That is so cool. Where is that bike? Does he still have it? Probably.
So he had it for quite a while, and a few years ago, he sold it to somebody up in, I believe, in Anchorage.
Huh.
So somebody up there has it. But that was a long project. It took 2 or 3 years, I think, for us to sort out how he was going to ride that. So I built him a bike and a trailer. I think I built two different trailers that we tested for quite a while. He tested it with a ton of weight and stuff, and just after a year and a half or a couple of years, decided that the trailer was not going to do it, and he needed to do it on a single bike. And so we built that, and it worked.
It sounds really strange, but it sounds like it would work. Just so weird to have the bike filled with fuel. It's like, don't light a match.
That's
the first thing I thought of is, oh my God, he's going to set himself on fire. That is so weird. Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brad Bingham about weird bikes from Bingham Built Bikes up in Steamboat Springs. So I have a question about your down tube decal.
Uh-huh.
It says Built, which I think is really cool. How'd you come up with that?
So Bingham Built was kind of the name that we came up with. But I was never that excited about having my name on the down tube. You know, I just didn't feel all that important. And I felt that it was, the word Built is a solid word, and could stand alone as a solid brand. So, you know, our business is Bingham Built Inc. And we pulled out the Built and used that for our logo.
You ever get any comments about it besides me asking?
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. On the seat stays of the bike, you'll see it says Bingham Built. And so hopefully that's a nice, you know, everything ties together nicely.
Yeah, sure.
Over the past, 2.5-3 years that we've been using that branding, I've had a couple of clients request actually that my name be on the down tube. And so for my new etched logos, I am offering that in the full. You can have the full Bingham Built on the down tube, and that looks really nice.
Yeah, it's interesting how people want that identification. Some do, some don't. I mean, I can remember people saying, I don't want any decals on the bike. And then, you know, for a long time, Waterford and Seven are building the bikes that we were selling. And it was like, they don't like that. They want their name on the bike. But I understand your perspective really well, actually. So let's talk a little bit about you personally. It seems like you like riding still a lot, and riding all different kinds of riding, gravel, touring, Grand Fondos racing. How many bikes do you currently own of your own?
So between, well, my wife and I together, it's somewhere between 12 and 15, maybe.
Oh, that's not unreasonable. Well, I guess it's all relative.
But me personally, it's really five or six, probably five bikes that I ride regularly.
What's your favorite?
My favorite two would be my current gravel bike. This one's a new one that I just built up a couple weeks ago, and my full suspension mountain bike. Because I did, you know, a handful of road racing events, some stage races and some single day racing, criterium racing. But really, as a competitor, I've done the very most in mountain biking. And so I love mountain biking. I love road riding. I love gravel riding.
Right. Right.
And of course, fat biking as well in the winter.
Did you have winter up there?
Did we have winter?
Yeah.
We had an incredible winter.
We did not. Very interesting that you had such a good winter. We had almost no snow, and the temperatures ranged from like 20 to 40. We didn't get any. I know. It was crazy. We're right on Lake Erie. It should freeze. Never froze once. It's very strange.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a great winter, and we ski quite a bit. We don't ride the chairlifts. We hike up the mountain and ski down in the morning. And, I mean, this year was just awesome. So much good snow.
Hmm.
And that's a really nice seasonal break from cycling. You know, if I lived somewhere like Tucson, I would just ride myself to death.
You guys own a tandem?
What's that?
Do you guys own a tandem? Do you ride a tandem?
We do. It's I think it's like a 1962 Schwinn.
All right.
No, we don't. Hannah and I, we do not have a titanium tandem right now. But there is one possibly in the works.
Yeah.
I've been accumulating some parts for it.
Yeah, I've only ridden a titanium tandem once with one of our clients, and Brian captained one for, strangely enough, a 6'8" guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he said it was the worst 100 miles of his life.
Oh.
It was really tough. But that's another conversation. So what are you doing during these times of social distancing? What are you and your wife doing to stay healthy and fit besides cycling? You can't say bike. You have to say something else.
Well, gosh, okay. That's a good question.
We don't do anything else is what you're going to say. Come on.
That's pretty much the right answer.
Okay.
We do ride. We both ride a lot. Hannah, she actually rides more than I do, for sure. You know, we've been taking care of ourselves pretty good. You know, we early on started social distancing pretty quick as soon as the word was out, and just working, I guess. Because it's myself and one other gentleman, I asked him to stay home for a while, and I had the shop to myself. I kind of kept plugging away.
Yeah, same here. Seems like we're busier now than we've been in a while. Well, this has just been a delightful conversation, but I have three questions I always need to ask. What's your favorite food?
Uh-huh. So pretty much just about anything Asian or Mediterranean. Those are my two favorites.
And what music do you like to listen to?
Kind of depends on what I'm doing, but let's just, since we're talking about work and what I do, at work, I really enjoy listening to jazz.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is. And then I have a soft spot because I grew up listening to so much Jimmy Buffett with my dad. Growing up, I kind of like that kind of, we'll just go ahead and call it like no shoes radio, kind of some of that, what do they call it? Yacht rock.
You know what? I don't know. I mean, I love that music, but I'm going to go back to jazz for a second. So, what kind of jazz do you like? Because that's what I like.
Yeah, I like anything. Like yesterday morning, I think I put on Miles Davis, "Water Babies."
There you go. There you go.
Early on, and then, but I like it all, and I don't claim to know it very well, but.
You know what you like when you hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah,
absolutely.
Last
I
question.
I like a lot of Latin jazz and.
Oh, nice. Do you like Pat Metheny?
Yes.
Ah, oh, there we go.
Yes, definitely.
Yes,
definitely.
And there you have it. The world's best. Yes. Okay. So, do you have any pets? That's my last question.
Yeah. So on New Year's Eve this year, we adopted two adult cats.
Good for you.
So we have so we have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old cat. I had previously a cat for 18 years.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. So, and in there we had a dog as well. And, I would imagine that there will be a dog in our not too distant future.
It's really hard when you're used to having pets in the house to suddenly not have them.
Mm-hmm.
We did that for about 6 months, and I'm like, that's it. I'm done. We need to go get another dog after we lost our last husky. So we now have two.
Yeah.
Well, Brad, this has just been wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with me. I hope that, are you going to go to NABS? Well, we don't know what's happening with NABS. Right now it's postponed, but who knows? But
correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, we've reserved accommodations for the Breck Epic mountain bike stage race.
Oh.
In Breckenridge, Colorado.
When is that?
I think that conflicts with
NABS this year. Hmm.
Yeah, with the August reschedule.
Yeah, Don and I talk all the time. Who knows? You know, I mean, it is rescheduled for now, but who knows?
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. I hope you have a great rest of your season. And if we get to NABS together at the same time, we'll say hello.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for the call.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye. Brad Bingham joined me from his shop in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Such a mellow guy. I'd really like to see that fuel-filled bike someday. And if you'd like to know more about Bingham-built bikes, I love the alliteration, you can log on to binghambuiltbikes.com. There you can see his galleries, how his process works, and check out the cool S&S coupled stem. I'm not sure why that tickled my fancy, but it did. So let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to tell you about a little non-scientific survey I'm taking about the custom frame-building bicycle business. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. There's been a lot of talk about whether we will see some fundamental changes in transportation and infrastructure as we begin to live the new normal. That includes whether we will continue to bike more and walk more, whether we will drive less and continue to work from home. And while we know that talk doesn't always translate into action, I was pleased to see Michelle Berukman's article about Seattle permanently closing streets to through traffic in an effort to enhance and promote walking and biking. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You are in gray Seattle. I'm in gray Cleveland, which is just like, even though they're on practically opposite ends of the country, it's about the same. So how are things there?
Well, things are not as they normally are because, of course, everything is shut down because of the coronavirus pandemic. But, I mean, otherwise, spring is merging and I think people are just sort of adjusting to the circumstances.
So I saw an article that you penned May 7th. You are a reporter for the Seattle Times. That was titled, Seattle will permanently close 20 miles of residential streets to most vehicular traffic. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting because this is this is everybody's dream if you live in a city and you are a cyclist. So I'm wondering how it came about. And I have a lot of other questions too, but I wanted to ask, were any streets already closed to vehicular traffic before the pandemic and prior to when you wrote this article?
Yeah, so, you know, Seattle has about 45 miles of what we call neighborhood greenways. And those are streets that are in residential areas and in neighborhoods that are sort of already prioritized for pedestrians and bicycles. They're calmer. They're not major arterials, and they're mostly in residential areas. And so streets that have been picked so far are along those greenways. And those are also, when Seattle implements the greenways, there's engagement process that involves community outreach. So that was already existing. And there's also some traffic calming measures that are on a lot of those streets, including traffic calming circles where cars are driving down, particularly if you're going down one of the hills in Seattle. It kind of slows you down because you have to weave around the circle. So I haven't heard, prior to this effort, I haven't heard of any large-scale efforts from Seattle to close city streets to vehicle traffic and convert them for pedestrian and bicycle use. That being said, Seattle has done some small-scale efforts. So, for example, downtown, there is a portion of a lane. I believe it's near McDonald's, but I haven't been up to downtown in 8 weeks, was converted to a parklet. I think it's called a parklet. Essentially, just a portion of lane where there's some planters and some chairs out, and encouraging people to kind of sit outside and have a little bit more room to do so. In Capitol Hill, there, which is another neighborhood in Seattle, Seattle was eliminating sort of a dangerous turn lane, and in kind of blocking off that triangle, just ended up converting that to a parklet as well. So putting some chairs out and having a little bit of space. And that's right near kind of a convenience store and in sort of a popular portion of the city where there's a lot going on. There was an experiment in the 90s to close a block of street near a shopping center downtown in Westlake, and that ended up getting converted back, but it still has raised sidewalks compared to the street. So it's still pedestrianized, even if vehicle traffic is allowed. And then in Occidental Park, which is in the Pioneer Square neighborhood of Seattle, when that park was created, the through streets for vehicle traffic were also brought in as part of that project and removed so that there could be park space. So there's been sort of efforts here and there, but I haven't heard of any similar type of effort as creating these stay healthy streets. And I should also say that these stay healthy streets are still open to local access. So people who are driving to their homes, still open to first responders, still open to delivery traffic. So not completely vehicle free, but certainly more so than was before.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Michelle Berukman. She is the editor of the Traffic Lab for the Seattle Times. You're the engagement officer. I want to know what that means, but I want to ask you a couple of other questions first. Who first proposed the change for these 20 miles? It's 20 miles of streets. Yes, for these 20 miles. Yeah. Who brought that up first, and how did it begin to go through the legislative system?
Yeah, so it's 20 miles that have become permanent. And then last week, Seattle also added about 3 miles in two other neighborhoods. So, I mean, the change was formally brought by the city of Seattle, kind of spearheaded by the Department of Transportation, SDOT, and then in conjunction with the mayor's office together. The director of the Seattle Department of Transportation and the mayor last week made the announcement. But sort of informally, this has been an idea that has been pushed by walking and biking advocates in the city, including an organization called Seattle Neighborhood Greenways. They've been very involved in outlining the streets that they recommend. They came up with a plan that would create 130 miles of open streets, and the SDOT director, Sam Zimbabwe, called that ambitious. Would love to get there eventually. I don't know if that's going to happen in the near future. And then, of course, this also follows similar efforts from other cities, including Oakland, New York, Minneapolis, Boston, Philadelphia. And Seattle has taken a little bit of a different approach than those cities, whereas New York, after apparently a little bit of initial skepticism or back and forth, announced a plan to make 100 miles of these open streets, say healthy streets, whatever they're being called. Seattle is taking more of a different approach where it's naming the streets first and coming up with the miles and kind of building forward versus sort of working backward. So it's been sort of a, I think, a community encouraged, officially led by a city agency project.
So I have a question about pushback. You know, when we speak of New York, of course, there was a lot of pushback. People didn't want bike lanes in their neighborhoods, send them to another neighborhood. And here I'm sort of hearing something different, I think, that these streets are being named first. Is there pushback? Are there people who are saying, I don't want my street to be one of these healthy streets, send them next door?
Yeah. So there's definitely pushback. As with almost any transportation project in Seattle, there's always differences of opinion. And, you know, some of the pushback has been similar to what we often hear, particularly when it comes to bicycle and pedestrian projects. I think those can kind of become coded words sometimes for people. So some people have raised concerns about traffic impacts to side streets. If you close off these streets, then people are still going to be driving. They're just going to clutter up other streets. Some people are saying certain streets are okay, but not this major street that I live on, or not this major area that connects to a lot of other services and institutions. Some people are criticizing the public process, or I guess they say lack of, but there wasn't an ability to comment on it. And those, I mean, this is within the, it didn't go through a legislative process. There wasn't, you know, a bill and then the city council vote or any sort of ordinance that, you know, the mayor went through and had engagement on. But that being said, these streets already had an engagement project, a process, so it wasn't that far off from the original goal in the first place. So, you know, that's sort of where it gets a little dicey, but I don't think it's out of the realm of what the mayor is allowed to control. And then there's, I mean, there are some, I would say, like, legitimate concerns around safety, you know, an expectation of if my child is playing in the street and, you know, they want to be able to do so and not have any fear of a car coming down, and if there's still local access and there's even fewer cars and therefore less traffic and congestion, will drivers go faster and hit someone? There was a concern in West Seattle along a waterfront portion that was closed, that was an area where people from other neighborhoods, particularly less wealthy neighborhoods, would come drive to those areas and park to get to see the view of the mountains and the water, and closing that off kind of makes it a space only for the wealthy people who do already live there and can get there by foot. So, I mean, there are some concerns, and that is, I think, also part of there's a joke that the Seattle process here of just to do things super incrementally in order to evaluate the feedback along the way.
Right, which isn't a bad thing, except that then it seems to take forever to get anything done.
Exactly.
Right. So I have a question, too, about whether anybody's looked at the economic impact. Now, most of the streets that are being closed, from what I understand, are residential, but do you see that there might be an economic impact to slowing, calming traffic and letting people ride and walk to places like bakeries and restaurants and when they open or if they're open and those kinds of things?
Yeah, so I don't know if there has been an economic impact done for these stay healthy streets. As you mentioned, they are in mostly residential areas. The idea, particularly during the pandemic, is that these are places where people would need to get to and have more access to get to by walking or by biking or some other method. But I will say, I wrote about a controversial bike project in North Seattle, I guess in 2018 and 2019, along a portion of of street called 35th Avenue Northeast, and there were some figures cited that some people felt like if you take away vehicle space, if you take away parking or just ability for people to drive to businesses, then sales at these institutions will go down. You know, I have a dry cleaning service or a bakery or this and that. People need to drive there. And then people who are biking advocates, they said the opposite. They said, oh, if I am biking along the street and I can smell all the flavors coming from the bakery on my bike versus in my car with my windows rolled up, I might be more likely to stop by the bakery and pick something up on my way to work. So I don't know the specific economic considerations for these, but I know that has been a discussion point between I guess advocates and people against the projects, similar projects previously.
So once again, we're speaking with Michelle Berukman. Here's what we're going to do. Talk about what it is she does. She is the editor, Traffic Lab Engagement Officer. Okay, what is that? What does that mean? What is the Traffic Lab?
So the Traffic Lab is a grant-funded project at the Seattle Times. As people may know, the business model of news organizations has changed dramatically over the past decade or two decades or so, as traditional revenue sources, print advertising, has dramatically fallen with the rise of the internet and other news sources. And so when all of this is happening, oftentimes newspapers have to make budget cuts, and that can include cuts to staff. And so there was sort of an effort that started with the first team, which was education, and then came to transportation, and now we have a third team that covers homelessness, to identify topics in the community that the community cares about and that the newspaper cares about, and find alternative ways to fund reporting of those issues so that we can preserve the coverage of those topics. And so transportation was a big one. And so as part of that, we get grant funding through different sources, and we are transparent about who those are, and that's all on our website. We also wanted to make sure that we are serving the community, and so that's sort of where my job and engagement comes in. And I believe there are similar type of roles at like nonprofit organizations, but this is sort of a very new area within journalism, and the idea is basically I am the reader's advocate. And so I try to take things from the perspective of a reader. I focus on questions that people have and answering those community questions versus topics that we in journalism deem important, or following topics that are come out of legislative hearings or things of that nature. And part of my job is reporting, and then part of my job is putting on events or opportunities for people to interact directly with us. So we've had panel discussions, we've had meet and greets, we just had a webinar on Tuesday. So that's sort of what I do, and how it's a little bit different, but it's essentially similar in what hopefully we will all kind of move toward in the coming years.
That sounds very progressive for the way journalism is going right now. Well, you know, first of all, when you tune in, if you want to call it that, to any major news source, or local for that matter, local news source seems to just regurgitate what's going on an either regional or national level, and it's all the same. It's, you know, COVID-19 24/7, and there are other things going on in the world. So the last thing I want to talk to you about is about how the pandemic has affected traffic in Seattle and what you see going forward. Do you have any sort of sense of whether, first of all, more streets are going to be bicycle pedestrian friendly, and whether people will go back to their old habits just because they can?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the $1 million question right now. So I have a story coming out either this week or next week about traffic patterns in the Seattle area and in Washington State, we are seeing that there is less highway traffic right now, but more traffic on neighborhood streets. And so to us, that kind of shows people are not commuting as much, not going to job centers and workplaces because they're teleworking or telecommuting, but they're still driving to the grocery store or to other services. And that data comes from the company Mapbox, which is a tool that's used by, I think it's over 45,000 apps, including Facebook, Snapchat, and the Weather Channel. You know, I think we're also starting to see a creep up of driving traffic overall, including on interstates. And meanwhile, we're also seeing other forms of transportation going through changes, biking. You know, one of my big critiques hopes is to have better measurements and tools to measure biking in the city. There are just a few counters scattered around, and I never feel like it gets a true picture of what biking looks like. And then there are census surveys, but that asks, you know, how many days a week, or that asks, did you bike? And sometimes it doesn't capture if someone bikes, say, 2 days a week and rides the bus 3 days a week. And I think overall, we are really interested in what teleworking will look like after this, or when we come out of this, if more companies will be open to that. And if that means that commuting might change, but then recreational travel might change as well. So I don't know the answer to that. And I also don't know, particularly as we are kind of facing a dire economic situation, what that will mean for funding of other kinds of projects. The Mayor Jenny Durkan in Seattle has promised expansion of bicycle infrastructure, but it's sort of unclear what that means and what funding will exist. The SDOT director says existing projects under construction will get completed, but again, not really sure what that means. So it's sort of an open question. And then meanwhile, we also have a new situation to face, the West Seattle Bridge, which is a major connection between people who live in West Seattle and downtown in North Seattle, now has crews have discovered cracks in the structure. So that's going to suck up a lot of the attention, and given other considerations, we will come to see what other transportation will come after this pandemic.
Wow. A big bridge problem. Yeah, we just went through a huge bridge reconstruction problem here over downtown in Cleveland. So I know how that, first of all, it snarls traffic, and then it sucks up all these funds. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. We've been speaking with Michelle Baruchman. She is the Seattle Times Traffic Lab Engagement Officer. If you are interested in the story we're talking about, it's from May 7th. It is titled, Seattle Will Permanently Close 20 Miles of Residential Streets to Most Vehicular Traffic. I think it's an awesome thing. We really like that. Thanks so much, and good luck with the traffic lab.
Thank you so much.
All right.
And thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You have a great day.
You too.
Michelle Baruchman is the Seattle Times Traffic Lab Engagement Editor. In addition to still being an employed journalist, which I wholly support, of course, it's interesting to see a shifting of how journalism might work in our new normal world. In addition to the article we discussed, you can find out more about Michelle's work at seattletimes.com/author/Michelle-Baruchman. So my thanks to both Brad and Michelle for joining me on the show this week. Last week, I asked you to post a photo of yourself riding outside. I loved seeing the photos of you, your bike, and all the different locations from where you sent the photos, including some from out of the country. You can see those on our Facebook page. This week, let's see, I'm thinking I'd like to know if you're going to go back to doing things you had stopped doing during the height of the pandemic. For example, are you going to go to the barber or hairdresser and get a haircut soon? or are you going to return to your place of employment or continue to work from home? And if so, are you going to use your bike to commute? So just leave a comment on our Facebook page. Next week, we'll be back with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. So I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.